also pasta, which is, you know, close to my heart, food that's close to my heart. And so I was like, oh my gosh, what about that? So, you know, we got to try to be critical, good critical food food scholars. And so so I was happy to find this saving evidence. Of course, you know, when you have a bias toward finding good evidence about something, it's, you usually do find it. So you have to kind of wonder whether you just hunted for the evidence you were looking for. But there's some reason to think that pasta products, maybe you've read this well. Go ahead and take a minute and read this. Maybe some of you chemistry folks can add to this. Right. So the idea is that it doesn't really address the nutritional degradation issue, but I noticed that pastas generally have high nutrition without being fortified. So that's kind of a way of inferring that, you know, maybe the extrusion process isn't as extreme. The other connection is that the cereal extrusion processes have very high temperatures and very high pressure. I didn't get the impression that pasta production did, but the most optimistic piece of evidence here is that the starches in pasta allow it to release its carbohydrates slowly, right? Are you guys with me? I mean, that's kind of, make sure you don't fall into your screens a little bit. You've got plenty of interesting stuff to look at on your screens, I know. But stay tuned in with us. So the point is that the worry you might have about processed pasta is that, like breakfast cereals, the processing could degrade nutrients and it could reduce fiber, which would accelerate sugar uptake. And so this suggests maybe that pasta is a genuine low glycemic index food because of the way the starches work in the processing. So I don't know. Maybe you guys have further research to do on pasta. I just keep the light off. Anything else? Yes.
I was kind of wondering, you mentioned earlier about, like, they added fiber into breakfast cereal.
Right.
Being different than normal fiber.
Right.
Can you tell that from the back of your nutrition box?
No.
And, like, how important
right.
are the two different fibers? That seemed like
no.
a pretty big deal. Like, I eat oatmeal, I'm like, is it
I know.
Added fiber?
I know,
fiber?
I know. It got me thinking. I mean, it came up very naturally in this conversation with my son this weekend, as you know. And so one thing I have learned from food studies in the last 4 years or so is that food labeling's very much a political process. So like we found with the lack of an RDA for sugar intake and other cases, you know, what it means, you have to kind of research what it means. The good news is there's just a lot of information out there. Some of it's contested, so it's, you know, you have to work it out. But yeah, I'd like to learn more about isolated fiber. As compared to intact fiber. But that's one of the differences we saw last class, was that isolated fiber doesn't slow sugar uptake the way intact fiber. So, yeah. Any other questions? Good. Okay, we're good? All right. Well, let's get into our reading for today. We do have a small quiz. Let's do the quiz. Okay. If you can fire up your forms, or if you're doing it on paper, that's fine, too. It should be an easy one. I was thinking about just 500 words, so one page, like a short essay, you know. And I was thinking about assigning it the beginning of next week and maybe Thursday. What do you think? Why don't you mull that over over the weekend and think about it? So I was gonna do like three topics and then have a little time in class to kind of talk about them, make sure that they're clear. Okay? Does that make sense? Yeah. I think so. We can negotiate that. Well, the one I'm sure I want to offer is what is food? You know, it might be two-page. I don't know. We'll see what the questions look like, and then we can talk about what it takes to answer them. I was thinking, what is food? And I'm open to you guys nominating things. You know, if you look at the study questions and you see how a couple of them could fit together, that's kind of what I do. So if you want to send me an email and say, I think a good question would be this. It seems like a good question area would be something around food, U.S. food politics, which we've studied a bit, and then something around around this soil hypothesis, maybe. You know, so we'll see. Just give you an opportunity to practice some, you know, higher level skills closer to philosophy than just kind of quiz questions. But other comments, questions, suggestions?
were the topics going to be sent through, like, email?
Yeah, you'll turn them in. So this is, okay, yeah, you get a reasonable question. So I'll probably prompt you in class, post them in the class notes, probably also send them an email because some people miss class. I'll ask you to turn them in anonymously through the Dropbox on Q&R. We haven't done that yet, so that's a little bit new. Basically, you will, you'll get a key which correlates your saint name to an animal name. And on your paper, you'll use that animal name. And then you'll upload it, and I like to share our work with each other. So we'll so this will allow, there'll be a way for you to see everybody's work. And part of the reason we do this anonymously is to avoid implicit bias, but also part of it is to be able to be transparent about grades, and to be able to be transparent about work. Students have reported that it's very helpful for them to see, you know, if they got a 7 out of 10, it's very helpful for them to see 10s. And even people who do well, it's kind of helpful for them to see where, you know, what the other writing looks like, you know. That's what I had in mind. Other questions? We can take other questions about it. I don't quite have all the. I think it'll be a choice from 3 topics, something like that. Is that helpful? Okay. All right. Great. If there's any other questions, let's have them. That's great. So I had 2 details to add to our food, diet design thing. One was kind of a follow-up from last class, and one kind of comes out of the Montgomery thing. So I just want to point this out. Point one of them out now. Do the Montgomery reading, and point out the others. So do the other one afterwards. So I've renamed the third one from practicality to practice. Because it seems like practice is a better term to capture all the behaviors associated with making food, enjoying food, producing food. Enjoyment comes up here. But it also includes practicality issues like where are you going to source your food, and do you have time to get the food from the places that you want to get it, and so on. So that's kind of a small modification to this kind of food philosophy schema that I'm working on. But the point I wanted to make about the diet design was just that, maybe this is really obvious, but I just wanted to kind of put this in front of you. Remember I was saying that it's like a puzzle, you know, you can think of it like a puzzle, and you've got these constraints that you're trying to meet. So so for instance, on nutrition, we're trying to get energy balance, right? This is the kind of the fancy term for a balance of calories in, calories out. We're also trying to get nutrient balance, right? So that's kind of the term, just to summarize what we've been talking about in terms of getting micronutrients, phytonutrients. And now in the new guidelines, there's even a suggestion that you get a variety of vegetables. You get some orange. So different colored vegetables, maybe I've mentioned this before, different colored vegetables turn out to have different classes of phytonutrients, different category, profiles of phytonutrients. So we're looking at energy balance, nutrient balance, and with that in mind, you know, just what would be the difference between, so let's say you're looking at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, just to simplify this. What's the difference between starting with egg and toast, based on what you know about these foods, versus fruit and granola? And raisins, say. Those are both great breakfasts. What's the difference in terms of nutrient and energy balance? What does it mean for your morning, basically? What do you think, how are these 2 different ways of kind of getting into your day, and how do they have implications for what you would eat for lunch? I want to get this puzzle concept out. Because it's like a puzzle. If you put this piece down here, or it's like a game where if you put this down here in the breakfast slot, then there are consequences, right, for trying to achieve different kinds of goals. And if we've got goals for nutrition, we've got goals for satisfaction, and eventually we'll talk about practice. So what could anybody speculate, based on what you know about these 2 foods? Yeah?
Egg and toast probably going to be a bigger breakfast, at least.
Bigger calorie-wise, you're thinking?
Yeah.
I think it might be more calories, yeah. Especially if it's buttered toast. That's what I like. Yeah. Yeah, so this is kind of this is going to be a relatively higher fat, higher protein, could be more caloric. It just kind of depends. Granola can be a wild card in the calorie thing, and it's also going to be it's going to feel different. I mean, this is going to give you a shot of sugar pretty fast. I mean, fruit's pretty much fructose. So you're fructose and sucrose. So you're going to So one of the issues is, how do you want to feel in the morning? I kind of slide into my day with kind of a high fat breakfast, relatively. But notice, so my point is maybe too simple. Maybe it's like we can just move on. But if you have any questions, the point is that if you make one move in your diet design, and it has implications for the next move, right? So you don't want to go from a high fat, high protein breakfast to a high fat, high protein lunch, right? Necessarily. Seems like you're kind of, because remember, you're trying to get nutrient balance in those ranges. So anyway, that's the point. Comments about that? Yeah.
Yeah, I have a roommate who right now he's like, he doesn't eat till like 9:30 at night, and he's trying to just have 1,000 calories like a day. So
1,000.
Yeah,
he's been cutting. Is he a little guy?
Yeah, he's pretty tiny. Okay.
Yeah.
But we've been trying to talk him out of that and like maybe have a little bit more workout or something like that. I just
want
to throw that in.
No, I have a friend who eats only fruit all day, and then she eats like maybe a really big dinner, just all vegetables and maybe lentils. And it's the same thing. I've tried to talk her out of it. It just seems wrong to me.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Some people can do it. There's an old Sicilian saying that a real Sicilian never eats before noon. So cultures have these maxims about like eating, right? I don't know that it's necessarily unhealthy not to eat until midday. I'm hungry in the morning. I don't know. Wait, you got some food back there. Anyway, any more comments? Yeah, it's a good comment. Any comments about this? So anyway, the diet design thing is kind of optional, but as we're kind of trying to put together, as we pursue more research that allows us to think about our diets, to think about not just nutritionally, but to think about them in terms of sourcing choices, right? And it's good to kind of keep up with that. So I'll have one more comment at the end of class, but let's get into our reading. Okay, if you guys could help me produce this a little bit, that'd be great. There's a lot of detail here. I don't plan to track it, in tremendous detail. I want us to draw, I want us to get the main ideas, the main information, and then I want us to try and speculate on the significance of it a bit. And as you know, from chapter 10, chapter 10 is where he tries to do that. He's trying to draw out the larger theses and claims in the book. And so this was, originally I had more chapters of this book in our course, and it's pretty detailed reading, so I did pare it down. But I'll pass this around just in case you're curious about the other chapters and, what he's doing in those. Okay, so let's see. Let's start our notes this way. Back in chapter 8. There's a few big topics here, right? Take a few minutes and browse through the chapter. Let me see if I want to figure out where I want to start here. All right, and then we have some local connections too. Did you notice the reference to? I was going to make a quiz question out of the Spokane reference. Yeah, mm-hmm. we're in the chapter, and unfortunately Quincy Washington is in the chapter too. Right, for a very sad thing that happened there. I didn't know about that until I read this book. But our author David Montgomery, as you know, is a UW star, and so he would be maybe tuned into this. And I have some other local connections to make. I'll bring those out. John Reaganold, somebody I learned about from reading this, and then learned some more about. Anyway, for your notes, let's just kind of parse out four major themes from the chapter, shall we? And then we'll fill in a little bit for each one. So I think one thing the chapter is doing is bringing you up to date on the story of big historical story, right? In the book, last class or the class before we were in Mesopotamia? It was two classes ago, right? We started out in Mesopotamia. So it feels like a whirlwind tour. It was. And there's even more in the book. But so what do we learn about China? We learn, earlier we learned about Loudermilk going up this river and discovering this ancient scene of erosion and failure of soil management. What you learn about here is that the emergence of wetland rice production actually was pretty good because the rice paddies had nitrogen-fixing algae in them. But early in the 20th century, China's still spending, like a developing country, China's still spending 70 to 80% of its income on food. And famines are a problem into the early 20th century. So the way we update China is to say by the end of the millennium, crop yields are down from soil erosion. Okay? But then the chapter really gets into a really big story about nitrogen and phosphorus. Could somebody take us into that? I mean, nitrates, we start to learn that nitrates can influence soil. But we didn't learn about nitrogen fixing plants until the mid-19th century. So what form did we discover? This is a kind of something missing in my understanding. What form did we discover nitrogen in? Because the guano is phosphorus. Is heavy in phosphorus? Is it heavy in both nitrogen and phosphorus? Let's see if we can figure that out. Help me figure that out. It's somewhere before page 187. I'm just curious about what the natural form of nitrogen, how did we find... They're a natural mineral phosphates. Okay, I know the story for phosphates, right? Remember the story, the point for your notes for phosphates is that we mined phosphorus and we couldn't make it available to plants until we learned a process that involved using sulfuric acid. And so what I'm trying to remember, maybe with your help, is what was the similar natural form of nitrogen? I guess it's from manure, right? Yeah. So the point for your notes would be that nitrogen and phosphorus were discovered in the early 19th century, and I think what we discovered was that the nitrogen was in the guano, was in the manure, right? Isn't that wonderful image at the beginning of the chapter of these Chinese fields where the animals, you remember that just from the start? The animals just kind of go out on their own to the fields, and they crap in the fields, and then they come back at night. I don't know. I'd like to read more about practices like that. But I think what we discovered was that we knew the manure was helping before we knew it was nitrogen and phosphorus. That's the point for your notes. And then there's a really cool story, if you're interested in discovering more about it, of the industrial process for nitrogen. As you know from the chapter, it's this guy Fritz Haber who discovers it. I listened to a podcast some time ago, I don't remember whose, and there's a really interesting story there, because Fritz Haber's wife was also a scientist, and she was denied recognition because she was a woman in a time when women weren't recognized for science, and she was also horrified when her husband, Fritz, figured out how to extract nitrogen, because he was helping the German war effort. And so these bombs were going to kill a lot of people, and they did. And so she actually committed suicide, is what I understood from this story. Sorry, it's kind of a negative story. But there are real dramas behind these discoveries. And how many of you thought it was interesting that the industrial nitrogen has this dual use, right? You know this from your American history, right? Timothy McVeigh got a big truckload of ammonia nitrogen fertilizer to blow up that building in Oklahoma, right? So the significance to me of this development is that if you were an alien looking down at humans, what would you say? You'd say, well, they didn't know how to manage soil, then they learned, and then they still didn't manage it, and then they learned about these additives, and then they went crazy for them, right? Look at the guano mining part of the story. Did anybody have some details from that? What were some of the details that show how extreme we were about pursuing guano? Just flip to that part of the chapter with me. Remember that? Remember the Franklin, remember the Franklin Pierce Act, Guano Island Act? So as soon as we discovered these soil amendments, we just put all our political, geopolitical energy, that's the point for your notes, we just went crazy for it. These things were, they could restore crop fertility, soil fertility. So that's one significance I think we should draw out of that. We even went to passing a law that allowed U.S. citizens to go out and independently claim ownership of guano islands. And we destroyed. You have the rape of Nauru. We destroyed some, at least one culture by just mining their island into obliteration. So it was kind of a gold rush over a kind of bird manure. So that's my point, is that you'd say humans... What's really disturbing about this soil story is that, remember last time we learned, Romans knew a lot about soil management, but they couldn't follow it because they were tempted by both, if I had to explain, I would say they were tempted by, I think what's motivating our frenzy about this is a fear of being hungry and an awareness that our methods aren't sustainable. And so when we find a fix, we latch onto it pretty aggressively. And that's consistent with the later part of the story where he's talking about nitrogen fertilizers in the US. So one thing this chapter really impresses upon me is that when humans finally figure out how to improve their crops, they don't stop and think, we don't learn the whole story completely. We learn a few things. We learn that this bird crap helps. We learn that phosphorus helps. But notice that we're taking a kind of single, a single chemical approach. So one lesson is that we have a kind of craziness about pursuing food. Here's what I'm trying to explain. In some areas, when humans learn something, they apply it immediately. Okay, here's what I'm trying to get at. In some areas of civilization development, when we learn something, we apply it immediately. In the area of food, we don't, and I find that puzzling. I find it puzzling that Romans knew how to sustain their crops, sustain their soil, and they didn't. I find it puzzling that we know vastly more than Romans knew, and we don't. And I wondered if you guys had some explanations for that. I have a couple, but I'm still kind of working on it. Any thoughts on that? Why is it that it's so difficult for us to make use of what we come to learn about how to manage soil sustainably? You'd think it'd be a no-brainer.
I mean, you look at like how wealth disparity is also increasing, you just kind of wonder who is actually profiting off of these unsustainable farming methods.
Right. Well, that you could pursue that thesis with our historical literature by saying, you know, the landowners didn't. When the soil stopped producing, they didn't try to figure it out. They just got more slaves, right? So that would be an exercise of unequal power. And likewise, if you're a big agriculture company, you're trying to grow food for export. You're trying to grow as much food as you can. How else? That's a good start. How else? How else would you explain? So what we're trying to explain is why have we been so unable to make use of emerging knowledge about soil?
I think a lot of people just care about, like, here and now, like, how are we going to get food now, and they don't really care about the future.
Short-term,
like,
long-term?
Like,
absolutely.
Deal with it later.
Yeah, so wealth and power is one thing that we've suggested. Short-term, long-term, right? One thing that government policy is supposed to do is help us get over that. I mean, government policy is supposed to help people. So you would think still that experts would say, well, you know, we've got to help the farmers. And we'll see some evidence of that in the 1985 and 1990 Food Security Acts. There's some good news at the end of the chapter, right, that we are actually starting to require farmers to have a conservation plan, right, that would address long-term. Okay, anything else? Yeah.
I feel like usually people can get away with, like, even after you're aware of the issue, of claiming that it's too demanding to, like,
right.
Everyone else, like, work that way.
It's more, sustainability is more work, there's no question about it. Another explanation would be that historically we've been able to move on, right? We haven't had to stay, you know, we've been able to kind of conquer more land. One of the points that Montgomery makes in chapter 10 is that, you know, that's not available to us. We could cut out all forests, I suppose. Yeah, the hypothesis, I think these are all great answers. The hypothesis I want to add is just that the psychology of food might be particularly powerful. You know, if you tell me there's a new pill that'll help cure some pain I'm in or a disease I have, I'm on it, you know. And most people don't have trouble getting their heads around medical advances that will immediately help them. But the psychology of food is motivated by a lot of fear. I mean, there's a book I read that I won't digress on, but it's called Fear of Food. And what this is a food historian, and what he documents is how even in growing food security, people consistently express fear about the future of their food. And that's puzzling, right? You would think that as we got better at growing food, people would relax and be less fearful about the future of food. But the point would be that part of our food psychology is to perennially fear the loss of our food. And maybe that's not so unreasonable, right? I mean, if the alien came down and you were trying to explain this to them, what would you say? You'd say, well, the thing you need to know about us as organisms is we can't go more than a few hours without it, right? I mean, we really need food. Are you guys thinking about your next feeding? Right, you know? And we already said, you know, we're sort of from the soil. We are kind of living soil. So if I had to kind of explain the psychology of food, part of it would be, well, look at us. Look at how dependent we really are on food. And look at how we get when our attempts to get food are frustrated or delayed, right? You can get a real panic, right? It's like, get me to that drive-up window now. Which is also interesting, because you can look at the way food is merchandised in a culture, in a wealthy culture, and it really helps us make sure that we never have to feel that fear. So anyway, I think these are all conspiring factors, and what I'm embarrassed about as a human is that when we learn about soil amendments, we just go crazy for them. We don't stop to integrate the emerging knowledge we have of soil health. Okay, so one of the themes in the chapter is to bring us up to date on contemporary soil management, and you get that you're going to get China, you're going to get the U.S. right. A second theme in the chapter is to give an account of the emergence of relatively limitless supplies of nitrogen and phosphorus, and to document that. Okay, so a third, we'll come back to this a little bit when we look at how that's affected U.S. soil. So a third theme in the chapter is this emergence of soil knowledge, and that comes out in a couple of spots. Let's see if we can document that. So the point for your notes is that we started out, some of our best authorities on nutrition and soil, like Justus von Liebig, whose name you're going to run into several times in the semester, this isn't the only time. I think we've already run into him before. Some of our best experts in soil in the late 18th century, thought that soil could never be depleted. That's really a big point for your notes, right? We thought soil was eternally a fertile. And you even get some documentation in this. You get some documentation in here of a fight between a West Coast soil expert, right? King, and the head of the USDA, this guy Whitney. And so Whitney's on the side. You don't need to remember these names, so I just want you to remember, right? I want you to have this in your notes that at this moment in history, you had this conflict between two authorities. One's the head of the USDA, right, in 1901, and the other is also a scientist, also an authority. And what they're arguing about is whether soils are perennially fertile or not. Okay, I'm glad we figured that out, right? But the point is that there's a real stubbornness to that, to the point where people have all these fights about it. How did we ever come to believe that soil was perpetually fertile? Crazy. Okay. So what do we want to say about the emergence of soil now? Do we want to say that it was contested, that it came from a default view that was fantastically implausible to our contemporary minds, right? Is that fair to say? That soil could be perennially fertile? What else? What else should we draw out from this one? I think that's pretty good. Okay, so then we shift to the second half of the 20th century. And I should have squeezed this in here, but you could actually get the Green Revolution right in here. So somebody give us a thumbnail gloss of the Green Revolution. What was the Green Revolution? This is the first time it's gotten on our agenda. We have a name associated with it, right? Guy who won a Nobel Prize for...
Did
I get that? Yeah.
Middle of the page.
What? It's up. Oh, Norman. There he is, Norman. Right. Sorry. Thank you. So Green Revolution is defined by the emergence of high yield strains of wheat and rice, combined with nitrogen fertilizer, and Borlaug got the Nobel Prize for that. He later warned people, he warned people in a speech not to think of this as a permanent solution. But what's interesting is today, not the documentaries we read, but in some other documentaries, you have contemporary scientists saying, basically, we need another green revolution, right? So why would you be suspicious of that now in light of this chapter? If someone came to you and said, well, what we really need to do is come up with super high yield plants and chemicals that can support them. Might be a good solution. There might be a second green revolution that nobody's imagined. But why might you be a little suspicious of that given what you read in this chapter?
Not sustainable
a lot of the time. What did the green revolution do well, and what problems did we get from it? That's a good way. It's not sustainable. That's a good answer. Let's unpack that. Why wasn't it sustainable?
Why did it
fail long term? Yeah. It had a number of effects.
For one, didn't it make farming really expensive?
It did. It added oil, start with your notes, right? It added oil inputs to farming. It added consumer inputs, things you had to buy at the store. So it added capital inputs to farming, right? And we have documentation from India and other places that it led to larger formations of farms, put a lot of small subsistence farmers out of the farming business because they couldn't compete, right? So when you had these high yield varieties of grains, the prices crashed. So the people were But the people who were big producers did better. They met their expenses. But the people who were trying to produce manually with fewer inputs, they just couldn't produce enough food to. So it's sort of like the story of U.S. corn. Remember in the documentary, U.S. corn putting Mexican corn farmers out of business? And then the corn farmers come over the border. They work in our meatpacking plants. And then INS comes and arrests them and deports them. So you have a kind of so that's one set of effects. So that's one thing for your notes. What's another set of effects from the Green Revolution?
It did address starvation. I mean, there was a remarkable. Somebody maybe could dig out a fact or figure from this part of the chapter.
It dramatically doubled. I think it doubled production over a decade or two. Does anybody have some of the details there? So the second effect, I'll just do it for you, is that by the 80s, population growth consumed the increase in yield. So notice, and make sure you put this in your notes, this is exactly the same dynamic we've been seeing since Mesopotamia. Come on, you know, humans, this is not the best moment for humans. We just keep, what we can't do is get our heads around the population food equation. When I was a kid, I grew up during the Green Revolution, so I was hearing from all these adult authorities, you know, as a much younger person than you guys are, that, wow, this is great. You know, technology is really solving the world famine problem. And in the 60s and 70s, we hadn't outstripped the increase in yields with population, but by the 80s, we did. So I mean, I think the significance you draw out of that is just as we have trouble controlling our use of soil amendments, we have trouble controlling our use of soil earlier in history, we have trouble thinking about the relationship between food production and population production. We've never evolved a political solution where people could agree to limit population growth. China came close to that with a disastrous policy, right? You know, they finally moved away from the one-child policy. It did actually reduce population growth in China, so it was effective. Fantastically unpopular, right? So that's just kind of something out there that, you know, the food problem isn't just a food problem. It's a problem about our psychology of food, but it's also a psychology about a problem about a blind spot we have in thinking about the relationship between producing food and producing people. I mean, if we can't get to a point where we think of those things as somehow in a balance without using some draconian political method that nobody wants, then we're kind of screwed. That's one lesson I take from this series of chapters. Okay, other details there? So that we've kind of talked about the Green Revolution. Let's get into the more optimistic part of the chapter. It's pretty fascinating, too. The emergence of organic farming. So you get a few details about this guy, Sir Albert Howard, who's saying, look, it's not enough to put nitrogen and phosphorus on your crops. There's something crucial about organic waste. This is like an early composter. Probably people thought he was pretty crazy. He was one of the first people to warn against synthetic nitrogen. He warned against plowing. And now we actually get into alt-ag. So when I designate alt-ag, I'm designating practices that go beyond refraining from pesticides and herbicides, right? Organic, so make sure you get this distinction in your notes. Organic, you know, means, you know, you're refraining from pesticides and herbicides, but it doesn't mean that you're concerned necessarily about soil erosion. It doesn't mean that you're necessarily concerned about soil health. And remember, we can do these taste comparisons if you want. You can do them in your home. Rich soil also produces more flavorful foods. Chemists call these flavonoids. I don't really know much about flavonoids, but these are compounds in our foods that account for the flavor of the food. And if you compare really rich soil, not just organic food, this is where the labels and the reality are hard to manage. If you really get organic food that comes out of really live soil that's full of organic material, the flavor is noticeable. And many of you have traveled, right? And we've talked about this before. When you travel to a food system like Italy's or France's, or maybe anybody have experience with Central or South American food cultures that are growing their food in older methods? then you really notice this difference between mere organic and what Alt Ag advocates, which is really rich, humus-rich soil. Okay, so that's early ag. And then Alt Ag is it's also characterized by a no-till or conservation-till movement. This was totally news to me before I started studying this. How many of you, maybe some of you are from farm backgrounds, how many of you encountered this no-till movement? There's a couple interesting, news to me. A couple interesting data points. This guy, Wes Jackson, if you look up the Land Institute in Kansas, they're doing something pretty cool. They've been working for about, 10 years trying to develop a high-yield no-till wheat. Before wheat was domesticated, it grew as a perennial, right? You didn't have to till it. It was just on the prairie, right? And the prairie was really thick, so busting the sod of the prairie was a historic moment for us. And so what these scientists are doing is they're trying to go back to those original wild varieties of wheat, but right now they don't produce enough to be commercially successful. So there's a hope. If I could just digress a little bit. Before we had modern corn, there's a reference to this in this chapter. Before we had modern corn, wild corn just was, you don't get much food from the wild plant. There's an amazing story about how people in Mesoamerica came up with modern corn. It changed everything. When we read the earlier chapter about Mesoamerica, remember it said the Mayan civilization grew because of modern corn, because you could, the nutrition. So an ancient corn stalk would be maybe this big, and it would maybe have, they grew them longer, they had maybe, it was called 8-row corn. And now, how many rows are there on a modern corn cob? Okay, so likewise, you've got the possibility maybe someday of Wes Jackson and this group in Kansas succeeding in coming up with a high yield no plow wheat. That would be revolutionary, right? So in your notes, this would be under the category of hopeful agricultural revolutions. You got to leave, right? Okay, good luck. Yeah, great. This would be under the category of hopeful future revolutions. If we could come up with more high yield, no crop, no till crops, we could kind of address. We could address soil erosion. And as you know, you get later in the chapter, you get an update on no till and conservation tilling, and it is catching on, not just because of federal mandates, but because it's making economic sense. Okay. A second hopeful future you get from this end of this chapter is the comparative studies on organic and commercial crops, organic and commercial farms. Do you remember this from the chapter? He cites maybe a half a dozen studies like this one, the Barry Commoner study, that suggests that organic farms can produce similar yields as industrial methods. And this guy, John Regenold, is mentioned in this, and he has a TED Talk I wound up looking up. You're welcome to look at. He's not a great speaker. He's a soil guy. But he's very persuasive. So there are these pioneers out there. And this fits, by the way, this dovetails really well. This part of the book dovetails really well with a book that I mentioned with a goofy title called The Lentil Underground. And it sounds kind of hokey, mysterious, but it's a contemporary food writer. And she's writing about, she's really good. She writes about basically in the 80s, very contemporaneous to this, in the 80s, these Montana farmers were having trouble making money doing oil-based monoculture agriculture in Montana. The story of the Lentil Underground is how this group of farmers developed organic methods focusing on legumes that can enrich the soil, and I think they did conservation tilling as part of that. And the company that comes out of that eventually, it's a lot of trial and error, it's a great story, is a company called Timeless Seeds, whose products you can buy, in the Northwest. So what they did was they managed to take a marginal industrial, this is the point for your notes, organic farmer, the story of Lentil Underground is typical of the stories that he's telling here, or successful organic farmers got off the oil addiction, is the way they sometimes say it. They got off the high capital input model of farming, where you need a lot of money to buy fertilizers, you need a lot of money to buy oil, you need a lot of equipment, and you need a really big farm. And so getting off that is a story you hear over and over again in contemporary food histories, especially from the 80s on, and Lentil Underground tells that story really well. And then you can go buy the food here. I think Rocket Market sells some of their food. So, okay. Another connection I want to make here is a little bit, maybe a little random. It's that when I used to take a group to Benin in West Africa, we had a study abroad program that ran for a number of years, originally a nursing engineering program, and then we brought the humanities in, and it, after the Ebola crisis, the program didn't quite bounce back. So we had to take a break. But it was a really great program. And when we went to Benin, we went to a place, you don't need to take notes on this, just a little information. We went to a place called the Songhai Center. And the Songhai Center is a pretty cool project started by this Dominican priest back in the 80s. So it's actually kind of one of these alt-ag stories, but it's in West Africa, right? So if you Google Songhai Center, you can see a picture of it right now if you want. It kind of make it a little bit more memorable. And what Father Nzama Joe did in the 80s, he was an engineer. He was like he was kind of a scientifically oriented Dominican priest, absolutely charismatic guy. I looked forward to seeing him every year for a few years running. And the Songhai Center was a demonstration project for sustainable, appropriate agricultural technology for Africans. And what were some of his principles? No fertilizers, right? First lesson, if you get people who don't have capital hooked on fertilizers, they'll never be able to do it. You'll have the same. So he was anti-green revolution. He wanted to use science and technology, but he wanted to use it to create organic and sustainable food practices. Anyway, long story there. I don't mean to digress too much on it, but I wanted to give you a kind of a third world parallel to the, you see where I'm going? I wanted to give you kind of a third world example to parallel the first world movement toward organic foods. Okay, you need to take off too, right?
Okay, to see you.
Okay, let me stop there for a minute and see if you guys have any questions. Yeah, sir.
In the reading, it said there's three spots around the world that you can continue this high intensity style farming. It's like it's in the middle of US, there's one place in China, like spending the rural areas. What is that? Is that just because there's specific soil content?
Remind me where you are. Where
I,
you are?
I don't, there's like one bit of the reading that says there's like three locations that you can continue this style farming. I think it was in the shorter reading.
Yeah, maybe it'll come up again. I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe you're thinking of the. There was some optimistic news about how Californians were doing better at managing soil erosion. Yeah, find the spot you mean. I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah. Any other questions, comments? Okay, so I hope we've connected a few dots here. Sorry about Quincy Washington. Anybody have any connection with Quincy Washington? No. Yeah, that was really sad. Okay, the last thing to do then is to kind of look at his larger thesis. So he's let's take a couple of notes. What he's trying to do is it's pretty straightforward. If you accept the thesis that we started with way back when we started reading Montgomery, right? That soil degradation doesn't directly cause decline in civilization, but makes civilizations more vulnerable to collapse. Then you naturally lead to the question, how would we have to think about the problem if we didn't want that to happen? And the answer is you'd have to think about the relationship between population and food production. And until we start thinking about that. And so he cites, could somebody see if this is true? Did the Catholic bishops really suggest that 40 billion might be I mean, that's not realistic, is it? Maybe that's an old thing they said. Maybe they don't believe that anymore. I don't know. But all the time I was growing up, there were these waves of anxiety about population explosion. Has that come up as a topic for you guys much as you were growing up?
Yeah,
A little bit? Okay, good. Whenever I've done it, I used to do it a little bit as a critical thinking research topic, and we'd always get this kind of answer that, we can keep producing more food, don't worry. And that's always been true. But what Montgomery's trying to say is we really have to get our heads around that equation. You might get to 15, so there are these, different people do these estimates. You might get to 15 billion if you just captured all the photovoltaic power of the planet, all the photosynthesis capacity of the planet, and you wiped out all other life. That's not such an attractive model. And then he makes this historical comment. He says, well, look, neither Marxist nor capitalist, the two major theorists about how production should work in the world, in the industrialized, post-industrialized world, neither Marxists nor capitalists had any theory about this. They both endorsed the idea that land was infinitely productive. So the point for your notes would be we don't have theorists until we get to the environmental movement. We just don't have major political theory that's embracing the fundamental equation between food production and population. And it may not be that we can't feed more people. It may be that as we come to try to feed more and more people, it just gets nastier and nastier. I mean, we just have to eat more degraded food. So, think about cheap calorie production. Industrial food production can keep producing more and more calories till there's a collapse. But it's gonna be less and lower and lower quality food. So one part of the equation is how many people in relation to food production. But then another part of the equation is just the rate of soil production. Maybe it's an inch every 1,000 years, and the rate of soil erosion, which might be an inch every 40 years. Okay. So we have gotten the number of hectares per person down, the number of acres it takes to feed a person, but that's one part of the equation. But we're still outstripping it. To get 20th century food, this is a good point for your notes. To get 20th century food production to double, we had to increase nitrogen fertilization by 7-fold, and we had to increase phosphorus by 3.5 times. So we're on a kind of, according to Montgomery, we're on an unsustainable treadmill. It would be great if any of you wanted to do some research to see if there are major critics of this perspective. I'm always open to that, right? I always want to know if I'm missing something. So if you guys want to, I haven't found that. A high authority critic who says, this David Montgomery, he's kind of crazy. But that would be a good thing to look to check whether you should take this seriously. But until I find somebody like that, I'm going to take this pretty seriously. Okay, we're almost at the end. Very interesting connection here. Look, agroecology is what he argues for. I'm calling it alt-agriculture, but maybe agroecology is a better term. And notice what he says. We need to treat soil as a locally adapted biological system rather than a chemical system. You guys hear the echo to nutritionism? Isn't that cool? So just as nutritionism is a bad reductive attitude toward food in which you see food as just nutrients, likewise, Montgomery is trying to say, how would we give it a word? Our pre-ecological approaches to soil were a bad reduction of soil to chemicals. Does that make sense? Should I say it again? So just as nutritionism is the ideology that is the bad reductionism of food to nutrients, likewise Montgomery is showing us that industrial soil management is a bad reductionism of soil to nutrients and minerals, to chemicals. So you have the critic about it. So that's when you get this distinction between just organic, mere organic, non-sustainable, California non-sustainable organic versus what alt-ag or agroecologists would argue for, which would be, much, much more than just not putting pesticides and herbicides on. Okay. How how do we get back to Paris and horse manure? I don't know. Anyway. Oh, right. The last connection I'd like to make, and then we can take some questions or just have some discussion. And there's one more point after that, but this is fascinating. Did any of you run across this when it was starting to be published? There's a lot of literature that's connecting three dots that are really important for us right now. One is climate change, the other is famine, and the other is war and refugees. So remember how we said in a class or two ago, remember Montgomery argued that farms that are experiencing soil erosion are more vulnerable to climate variation? Do you guys remember that? Okay. So the five harvests before the Syrian war were failures, which a lot of people think is driven by climate change. Whether you think, whether it's global climate change or not, the point is that Syrian farmers had weak soil management, and so we have this connection between, put it in your notes, the connection between climate change, crop failure, war, refugees, political vulnerability, ISIS. I'm not trying to explain everything by food, but it's a pretty powerful thesis. Are you feeling it? Remember, Montgomery's been saying all along, soil mismanagement doesn't directly cause civilization collapse, empire collapse, but it makes empires vulnerable. It makes them politically vulnerable. It makes them vulnerable to the weather. So I think that's just a really neat neat connection to make in this context. Okay. So, questions? We're good? Yes, sir. Did you find it good? Yeah, where are you?
It says, page 244, bottom of the left side.
Good. Now you lost it again.
Last paragraph. It says, there are three great regions that can sustain intensive mechanism.
Right, good.
The wide expanses of the world, lowest belts in the American plains, Europe and northern China, where thick blankets of easily farmed silk can sustain intensive farming. I don't understand why those three locations, just because...
And I don't understand how they could sustain it once the soil disappears, either.
That stuck out to me as contradictory.
Is anybody just thinking about the Central Valley of California is just an incredibly rich... Has anybody driven through Central Valley, California? Yeah.
I'm from Fresno.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was one of the areas he's talking about here, right?
Yeah.
Is it still really fertile?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Except now there's issues like too much water.
Oh, right. Now you guys are... Yeah,
right. Right now it's like...
Yeah, you went from... Okay. You're out of the drought. Good news, you're out of the drought.
Yeah.
Yeah,
except
that's
good. Now there's flash floods. So.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, good. I don't know what to make of that, but I don't have a complete explanation of that. It seems like he generally wouldn't say stuff like that. So I see why it's a surprising claim. Good. Yeah. Hadoop? Yes.
Well, that last point about Syria, I heard this maybe a year or two ago.
Sure.
I think we have there's a silo of all these old grains and stuff that we're keeping. And I think it was Syria was the first that had to actually, it's like an emergency reserve of grains, and they were of seeds.
Ah, okay.
I think Syria was the first one that had to actually take grains out of it.
Ah, interesting. Who maintains that? Is that a UN thing?
I don't
okay.
know.
Okay, right.
Right,
no, it's good to check on it. It's
so,
really...
It's actually up in northern Norway.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah, you might not
know
that. And it's like a seed bank, like an emergency seed bank, or like...
Yeah,
right.
So like every
cool.
single type of seed.
Wow, that's very cool. Yeah, I've read about those. I didn't know that. I think there's more than one, but this one was available for this crisis, right? That's neat. Yeah, good. Yes, please.
I actually just read today or yesterday that in Somalia, Yemen, and one other country, their population is, they say, pretty close to being declared starving.
Wow, yeah, no, Yemen's, definitely.
So,
Somalia, Yemen,
yeah. There's a group of organizations who are trying to figure out ways to get food there because they
absolutely.
Can't grow, one because of soil and
right.
two because of war.
Right.
So
right.
they're now trying to figure out how to do it because people are,
good.
They say 100,000 people have died in Yemen, I think, already.
Wow.
Just
yeah.
from starvation. So
yeah, and I have heard recent news about Somalia. I think Somalia is headed for a real crisis. It's really good to connect these things. I mean, we've got, so then we have that that ethical problem. My ethics students are talking about obligations to the absolute poor, and you can have this impulse to say, oh well, we need to feed them, you know, but that's a short term, you know, that's a real short term strategy. I'm for emergency famine relief as well, but every time we've intervened, it seems like we've done it to create another crisis a few years down the road. Difficult problem. The last point I'd make, it really just gets back to this little diagram, is that does it make sense to say all roads lead to soil? Can we just look at this little diagram in terms of, so what's going to affect this soil? Right? What's going to affect satisfaction and flavor and enjoyment from food? What's going to be that it's grown in good soil? And our practices have layers. We're going to go into this more later. I mean primarily your individual practices, and I mean like your own personal supply chain. You know, some of you are using Safeway for your supply chain, but you know your own personal food economy. But notice that that doesn't exist in a vacuum. There's also a local food system that affects how close you can get to the soil with your food purchases. And then, of course, there's a national system, right? And so your practices are your individual practices, but they're layered on top of a food system that will or won't connect you to soil, depending upon how it's run, right? The more it's an industrial processed food system, then your individual practices are constrained to that, right? So being in a food desert is defined by having not being able to practice food behaviors and cooking on really good food, and that's because you're cut off from food that actually comes from good soil. So my final point is that, you know, kind of wrapping up the Montgomery chapter, is that in the food philosophy I'm working on anyway, you guys don't have to accept this, all roads lead to soil. It's really, I mean, ultimately we ought to be really concerned about whether our food comes from really good soil, not just whether it's organic. Later we're going to add other requirements, like maybe we should be concerned about who makes the food and how they're living, but that'll come later. Okay, should we stop there? Okay, thanks a lot for your attention, guys. See you.